These latest world news headlines.
Kenya's president heads to the Netherlands. Officials want to know how a Spanish woman contracted Ebola. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has left the country to attend a hearing on his case at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Mr. Kenyatta flew out of Nairobi today. He is facing five charges of crimes against humanity for allegedly helping organize the post-election violence that hit Kenya in 2008.
Court is now in session. Ludensala Court Penal.
There was a hearing in the case today. The Associated Press reports that International Criminal Court prosecutors are accusing Kenya of refusing to comply with requests for information that could form evidence against Mr. Kenyatta. A new report says at least 11,000 people have been killed as the result of the Boko Haram insurgency in northeastern Nigeria. The estimate comes from researchers at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who used media reports to compile a database on violence in Nigeria going back to 1998. In an article published in the Washington Post, the researchers say the Boko Haram conflict has become one of the deadliest in the world. Spanish officials are investigating how a nurse in Madrid, Spain, contracted the Ebola virus. She has become the first person known to catch the disease outside West Africa, which is currently the flashpoint of the outbreak. Health officials say the woman helped treat two Spanish missionary priests who died last month after being flown back from Liberia and Sierra Leone. But they say all proper safety procedures were followed in the care of the missionaries. For more on the story, go to our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Experts from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank say Ebola is hurting the economies of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. The IMF said Ebola is causing dire economic problems in parts of West Africa. The assessment came today as the Global Lender published an economic forecast for all of sub-Saharan Africa that says economic growth in Africa overall may rise to 5.8% next year. The Reuters news agency reports that anti-Balaka militias in the Central African Republic are calling for the president and the prime minister to resign. Edward Patrice Ngaisona, who heads the Christian Anti-Balaka Coalition, is ordering movement ministers to leave the government. Sectarian turmoil seized the country when the mostly Muslim Seleka Coalition took over the government in 2013. Sectarian violence has forced about a million people to flee their homes. Prime Minister Mahamat Kamoun has been trying to reach an agreement with Muslims and Christians that would allow the groups to share power in the government. The latest action is seen as a blow to his efforts. The AFP News Service reports that a court in Malawi has ordered the jailing of a senior government official in the Cashgate scandal. It's the first sentence handed down in the scandal that has led some nations to suspend foreign aid to Malawi. Former tourism ministry official Treza Namathunga Senzai pleaded guilty to stealing $150,000 from the government. She's the first to be sentenced in what is believed to be a swindle worth millions of dollars. Hong Kong students and government officials say they have reached an agreement to begin formal talks. After meeting with student representatives today, the Undersecretary of Constitutional Affairs said the talks with the territory's chief secretary would begin on Friday. One person was killed in southeast Turkey today when police fought with hundreds of pro-Kurdish protesters demonstrating against Turkey's inaction toward Islamic State militants. Turkish media issued conflicting reports that the protester was shot or hit by a tear gas canister fired to disperse protesters in the city of Muş. Police fought with demonstrators around the country, including in such places as Istanbul and Ankara. Indian and Pakistani forces exchanged fire across the border between Indian-controlled Kashmir and Pakistan. Nine civilians were killed in an exchange of gunfire Monday, marking the highest civilian death toll in the conflict over the disputed Kashmir region. Other civilians have been wounded. Each side has accused the other of provoking the violence, which began Sunday night. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are down at this hour. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the response to this very serious emergence of Ebola was not optimum. There were things that likely should have been done earlier and more aggressively. What we have in place with the WHO, with all due respect, did not work well.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He spoke today during a briefing on the West Africa Ebola crisis. Also, an infectious disease specialist says using mobile technology is key in tracking Ebola. A new report says at least 11,000 people have been killed as a result of the Boko Haram insurgency in northeastern Nigeria. And the ICC begins a 2-day status hearing on the case against Kenya's president. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the first detected case of Ebola infection in the United States remains in critical condition today in a Dallas hospital. Thomas Eric Duncan, a Liberian national visiting the U.S., was admitted to a special infectious disease unit at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital on September 28th. Hospital officials say he is receiving an experimental treatment called Brincidivir. The treatment's developer, Chimerix Incorporated, says its tablets have been safely used for other viruses. U.S. health officials say 10 individuals Duncan was in contact with during his visit are still being monitored. So far, none of them show any symptoms of the Ebola virus disease that has killed an estimated 3,500 people in 5 West African countries. The discovery of a case of Ebola infection in Texas has spurred U.S. government debate over increasing testing of passengers flying to the U.S. from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. President Barack Obama says the White House is considering increased health testing of passengers from those countries, but he resists calls for banning all flights from West Africa. The fifth American evacuated from West Africa after testing positive for Ebola spent a second day at a medical center in Omaha, Nebraska. The father of the NBC News freelance photographer says his 33-year-old son, Ashoka Mukpo, is experiencing mild fever and nausea. 4 Americans previously evacuated to the U.S. for intensive care have recovered and have been released. In Madrid, a nurse who tested positive for Ebola is now under hospital treatment. She is the first person known to have contracted the virus outside the 5 countries battling the epidemic. A second nurse and 3 others are in quarantine, and more than 50 other people are being monitored. The 2 nurses treated a Spanish priest who died September 25th, shortly after his medical evacuation from Sierra Leone. Doctors treating the lethal virus continue to rely on experimental drugs or transfusions from those who have recovered from the virus. None of those procedures have been clinically proven safe or effective for Ebola. In past months, a handful of West African and foreign health workers received a limited supply of the experimental drug ZMapp. U.S. health officials say that supply is now exhausted and will not be available again for about 2 months. The results of tests using ZMapp and reported in the journal Nature are described as encouraging but still speculative. The drug saved the lives of all 18 rhesus monkeys infected with Ebola. A second drug, TKM Ebola, from Tecmira Pharmaceuticals, has been used on at least 1 human patient. In Sierra Leone, political opponents of President Ernest Bai Koroma charged the government with failing to release a shipment of Ebola protection kits, stretchers, and mattresses at the port of Freetown. They say the shipment sat at the docks for weeks. It is worth about $500,000. Well, the international response to the West Africa Ebola crisis was criticized today at a briefing at the Wilson Center think tank here in Washington. The World Health Organization was criticized for its slow response and failing to adequately heed a warning from Doctors Without Borders that the epidemic was out of control. However, donor countries were also criticized for reducing their contributions to the WHO, causing the UN agency to reduce its programs and resulting in many employees seeking other jobs. Among those speaking at the Wilson Center was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He was asked whether an international emergency response team should be created to deal with such crises.
The response to this very serious emergence of Ebola was not optimum. There were things that likely should have been done earlier and more aggressively. What we have in place with the WHO, with all due respect, did not work well. And so I think we need to look at the response, whether that's a rapid response team. Sounds like a good idea. Where it would be based and who it would report to would obviously need to be worked out. But I think the experience that we've had with Ebola tells us that we have got to do something different because we lost a lot of time. And this is particularly relevant with regard to how Ebola emerges, because once you get to an escalated level of cases that essentially occur in an exponential fashion, then it becomes that much more difficult to control it. So had this been controlled early on, we might not be in the situation we're in right now.
Dr. Fauci says in the future, the response has to be different and more nimble than what has been done so far in West Africa. He stressed that at this time, there is no evidence the Ebola virus is airborne like a flu virus.
If you look at the history of viral diseases, during the evolution of them, during an epidemic, we have seen slight to modest shifts. Something can become a little bit more virulent, a little bit less virulent, a little bit more efficient in spread or not. But to my knowledge, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I have been always confronted with that question, is that it would be unprecedented, and then you have to say to the skeptics, not impossible, but unprecedented for a virus to completely change its modality of transmissibility. I've not heard of that. I've not seen it. Not only in experience, but in looking at the literature. Now, again, someone could always come back at you and say, yes, but that's still not impossible. And we'd have to admit it is not 100% risk-free. But given what we're going through now and the destruction that is occurring in the current form of transmission, I think this is something that we don't need to focus on and create a great deal of anxiety.
He said that if the world fails to end the West Africa Ebola epidemic, it will spread to other countries. Fauci added that despite several hundred health workers being infected with Ebola, it is not typically a common occurrence.
People who use personal protective equipment and are well-trained, it is extraordinarily rare that they get infected. In fact, Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, who have been working on Ebola epidemics from the very, very beginning, have rarely, it was essentially no one had gotten infected in MSF with Ebola due to their training and their ability to use that equipment properly. I believe recently one of their colleagues got infected, but that was a very, very rare event. Most of the healthcare worker type infections that have occurred in first-line healthcare workers who were confronted with someone before they even knew that they had Ebola. There have been a few situations where people who were well-trained and had personal protective equipment and did get infected. It is likely some inadvertent breach of protocol. We've been told by people with experience that one of the things that can be a problem is that people work for hours and hours in very hot temperatures with fatigue, and then there is an inadvertent break. And that could be either when they take the equipment off or somehow putting it on or what have you. So it isn't perfect. People are well trained, but if done properly, it's a rare event, but it does occur.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Also speaking today at the Wilson Center in Washington was Dr. William Schaffner. He's chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. That was Dr. William Schaffner. He was chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, and we were not able to get him speaking. Actually, he did speak today at the Wilson Center, and here he is coming up now.
We are indeed a small world, and we are much more interrelated than we ever were. We can no longer think of the forgotten problems of forgotten people because we're all so interrelated. In addition, we've had enhanced expectations that in the 21st century that these sorts of health crises need a response, and that's an appropriate expectation for the very reason that we're all so interrelated. We learned much after SARS, and communication about health issues was distinctly improved, and that showed to be the case during the H1N1 influenza pandemic. Mexico was wonderfully free and open with its communications in that regard. Some of this apparently has been lost. We need to get it back. And with Tony, I'm not exactly sure what form this would take, but we surely ought to think about it and try to put something in place. We need an epidemic response unit.
That's Dr. William Schaffner, chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He spoke today at the Wilson Center think tank in Washington. Well, contact tracing has become a well-known term as the world learns more about the Ebola crisis and how to contain it. It was through this method that people who came into contact with Liberian Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan were notified that they were exposed to the Ebola virus. Infectious disease expert Dr. Joel Salanicchio says time is of the essence in getting communication out to people in a crisis situation like this. His company, Magpie, uses a mobile data collection and messaging software tool in Africa and other regions of the world to get information to people immediately. He explains how this technology is vital in stopping the spread of Ebola.
So what Magpie does is it recognizes that within global health, for example, during this Ebola outbreak, there's a lot of information that needs to be collected. I'm sure that your listeners and viewers have heard of contact tracing at this point, something I think very few Americans were aware of before the case in Dallas. The thing that has to happen in Dallas, besides treating that poor man with Ebola, is to track down everyone who might have come in contact with him. And when they track them down, they don't just sort of make a couple notes on a notepad. The CDC team that is working to track those people down develops a database. They have a form where they write down the person's name, the contact information, the symptoms that they may have, any other illnesses they might have or conditions, medications, et cetera. A whole variety of different pieces of information that have to be collected for each of those potential contacts so they can monitor changes over time. And unfortunately, in most cases, and I'm sure in almost every single case in West Africa right now, that same kind of contact tracing is, and other data collection activities is done on paper. Now, you can imagine with the unbelievably time is of the essence situation that we have with Ebola that spending 3 days typing that information into a computer just isn't good enough. So contact tracing is one way in which we can dramatically improve the speed and efficiency of the response to Ebola. And what it means when you cut days or even weeks off the time required to do that contact tracing is that there are people who, with a paper system and all those delays, would get Ebola or who would not be identified or treated. Essentially, you can reach those people faster.
Looking at the countries where Ebola is hitting the hardest right now, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea,
yes,
what can these countries be doing right now with this technology that will help them since the crisis is already there and it's spreading?
In all of those countries, there are all sorts of activities related to collection of information. Contact tracking, again, is one of them. I've been in conversations with numerous organizations and agencies, including some of the Red Cross organizations, for example, during the course of this week. For example, there are villages where an Ebola patient came out of. And what that means is that essentially everyone, maybe 200 people or 300 people in that village, they're all potential contacts. Now, there's no place to bring these people and put them in isolation, but somehow we want to be able to monitor the people in those villages to see if anyone develops symptoms. How can we do that at a distance? Well, if we can have basically self-reporting from the villages, where each of the villagers uses their own mobile phone or one that's accessible to them, to report when they develop symptoms, so the authorities know about it and can then divert resources to finding that person and treating them appropriately. That works much better than, for example, if we have to say, we'll just every single week drive out to every single village in the country. First of all, weekly isn't enough. You want to immediately know when someone develops Ebola symptoms. But these are very far-flung villages in a very poor country with poor infrastructure and poor roads. So again, driving out to every single village to check every day to see if one of the many, many, many potential contacts is actually developing symptoms isn't going to fly.
Do you think the use of the mobile phones is also a good way to overcome the cultural barriers that are also apparent in these countries that are preventing some people of acknowledging their symptoms?
Well, I think the best answer to that question is to say we think of these mobile phones, we call them phones, right? But certainly in the United States where we have Android phones and iPhones, et cetera, I think we've begun to shift and recognize that what these devices are is much closer to our desktop computer or a laptop computer than it is to, for example, an old landline phone hanging on the wall. You know, there are all sorts of things that we could do if, for example, everybody in West Africa, every single person, let's say, had a nice laptop computer connected to the internet. The fact is that the mobile phones these people have are not as capable as your laptop computer or even, for example, your iPhone doing those things, at collecting data or doing education or communication. But they're better than nothing. They do allow us to call these people to provide educational information. They do allow us to alert people via text messaging. They do allow us to submit, to have these people in villages, for example, submitting information, or people from labs submitting information about cases that test positive, et cetera. So if you think of the population of West Africa, and you think of all the mobile phones that they have, and there's probably, I mean, in the cities, 100% of the population has a mobile phone. In the countryside, it's probably closer to 40 or 50% of the population has a mobile phone, but everyone has access to one.
That was infectious disease expert Dr. Joel Salonicchio, founder of the data collection mobile technology company Magpie. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Twenty-two minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new analysis by the World Bank called African Pulse says the continent's economies are expected to grow at a moderate pace up to 5%. But it also warns that the Ebola crisis could deal a blow to the three states most affected by the virus, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Francisco Ferreira is the World Bank's chief economist for Africa. He explained to reporter William Eagle how the disease could affect economic growth.
It almost certainly will cut growth in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. You know, not so much because of the direct costs of the epidemic, which are incredibly severe in terms of lives and suffering, and are, of course, our primary concern. But economically, those direct effects are not so large because at the moment there are still a few thousand people. But the fear they create, the what we call the aversion behavior on other people, on farmers, miners, workers, consumers, that's really reducing GDP by between 2% or so this year in Guinea, more like 3.4% in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which adds up. Those countries are not rich, obviously, so those proportions add up to around $359 million in our estimates for this year.
We're talking here about aversion behavior on the part of farmers, consumers, miners, etc. Do we have any evidence yet that this aversion behavior may be hitting outside investors?
Yes, we have in Guinea one iron ore mine closed and another which is still in operations but that has suspended some investment, placed it on hold. They may invest in the future, but they are not investing now on another mine that they were going to. So we do see impact already in that sector. We also see, of course, massive impact on tourism, not only to these three countries, but also to some neighboring countries, including some neighboring countries like the Gambia, which depend quite heavily on tourism. and which do not have any case of Ebola yet, but are already suffering from that kind of contagion. So, yes, we do see that kind of impact.
The World Bank is mobilizing a $400 million financing package to help especially the three hardest-hit West African states. How will this be used?
The three main priorities are healthcare. So I know that some of the money is going into an emergency response that has to do with the supply of protective equipment, you know, those suits and gloves and sorts of things that healthcare workers need in these countries. As we know now, Ebola is particularly hard on healthcare workers. A number of the people who've died are healthcare workers in these countries. And also now with the increased amount, as you say, now it's 400 million that have been mobilized. Some of it is going into treatment centers and field hospitals. As you know, in Liberia in particular, but also in Sierra Leone, the health systems are stretched, you know, in the case of Liberia, beyond capacity. There's no capacity left. There are people literally being left outside the door to die. So there's huge need for additional centers where additional beds can be provided, and the doctors and nurses that are being mobilized by the international community and by the African Union can work. So that's where, you know, a chunk of the money is going to. So the first priority is the emergency response on the health front like that. The second priority, which I think will kick in a little later, is a rebuilding and a strengthening of the health systems in these countries, including the system for monitoring the outbreak of contagious diseases. The third priority, and I know some of the money is going to that, is just general budget support. These governments never have been particularly rich, and they've had to redirect scarce fiscal resources towards the response. And so they are facing larger fiscal deficits and financing problems, which, if unattended, could, you know, lead to higher inflation. And the last thing you want in a country dealing with these problems is food prices to be rising and so on. So some of the money will go in budget support.
That was Francisco Ferreira, the World Bank's chief economist for Africa. He was speaking to reporter William Eagle. A new report says at least 11,000 people have been killed as a result of the Boko Haram insurgency in northeastern Nigeria. The Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies used media reports to compile a database on deadly violence in Nigeria going back to 1998. In an article published in the Washington Post, the researchers say the Boko Haram conflict has become one of the deadliest in the world. They estimate that 7,000 people were killed between July 2013 and June of this year, and say casualties from the conflict are piling up at a higher rate than those from the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. The estimate includes casualties caused by Boko Haram attacks and operations by the military. Rights groups have accused the military of using indiscriminate and heavy-handed violence in an effort to stop the insurgents. The researchers say that overall, nearly 30,000 Nigerians have been killed since 1998 in various acts of ethnic, religious, political, and economic violence. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately. Because infected people have a much higher survival rate, if they receive early treatment at a health facility, compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The first detected case of Ebola infection in the United States remains in critical condition today in a Dallas hospital. And an infectious disease specialist says using mobile technology is key in tracking Ebola. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. It's time now for sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Impuga sitting in for Sonny Young today. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we kick off with African football.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Seven countries have submitted a bid to host the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has revealed that they are Algeria, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, Kenya, Sudan, and Zimbabwe. Nominations were opened on August 23rd following the withdrawal of the regional host, Libya, with the deadline for the bid set as September 30th. The host country will be decided by the CAF Executive Committee during one of its sessions next year. CAF said that due to the limited time frame for the organization of the finals, in making a decision, the executive committee will focus on the host with acceptable infrastructure and facilities required, such as stadia, training grounds, accommodation, and communications. Of those bidding, Kenya and Zimbabwe have not hosted tournaments before, though both have had winning bids. South Africa replaced Kenya as 1996 hosts after the East African nation fell behind in its preparations, while Nigeria and Ghana co-hosted in place of Zimbabwe in 2000 due to lack of funding. Algeria were hosts in 1990, Egypt in 1974, 86, and 2006. Gabon were co-hosts in 2012. Ghana did host in 1963, 1978, and 2008, and they were co-hosts in 2000. Sudan hosted the inaugural event in 1957 and again in 1970. Libya was stripped of the right to host the continent's showpiece tournament in August, as ongoing fighting in the country delayed plans to build new stadiums for the 16-team finals. The North African nation was originally scheduled to hold the Nations Cup in 2013, but because of the unrest, swapped with 2017 host South Africa. Morocco will host next year's finals, and final group qualifying matches are already underway. In September, CAF awarded Cameroon the 2019 finals and Ivory Coast the 2021 edition, while Guinea were handed the right to host the 2023 edition. There are growing calls to schedule the 2022 Winter Olympics in order to accommodate football's World Cup in Qatar. It's expected that the World Cup will be moved from summer to winter in 2022 to avoid high temperatures in Qatar, that's according to media reports. The Winter Olympic Games haven't been awarded yet. Sepp Blatter, president of World Football's governing body, FIFA, has suggested a switch to November and December 2022 is almost inevitable, but Europe's top football clubs are concerned that that would shut down the European leagues for 8 weeks. Another possibility is to stage the tournament in January and February, although Blatter has assured the International Olympic Committee that the World Cup will not clash with the 2022 Winter Games scheduled for February. Blatter is an IOC member and thought that any disruption to the 2022 games could jeopardize football status as an Olympic sport. Among the other events that could be affected is the 2023 Africa Cup of Nations. is due to be held in Guinea in January and February 2023, but it would be very difficult to do so if the 2022 World Cup was moved to November and December, although switching the World Cup to the start of the year would leave the way clear for the African tournament to go ahead as scheduled. The 2022 Winter Olympics will be held in either Beijing or Almaty, after also pulled out of the race to stage the event last week. According to media reports, the task force set up by FIFA to decide on the best date for the 2022 World Cup features a variety of stakeholders, including clubs, leagues, and player representatives, and will meet again in November before a final decision next year.
This is VOA's Nikki Nicole Lindsay. I want you to know that Sunny welcomes your comments. You can send your emails to Sunny at the following address: sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. For those of you who don't have email access, write this down: The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. We appreciate your contributions, so drop us a line when you get a chance.
Missing breaking news is something that you never have to worry about.
VOAAfrica.com.
It's always there on our website, VOAAfrica.com. First, fast, fair, and in-depth news is what you get.
And now on to tennis. Britain's Andy Murray overcame a second set blip against Tayabra's Gabashvili in the Shanghai Masters first round with a 6-1, 7-5 win. The two-time champion took little time to take the first set, but numerous errors with his forehand in the next set saw him struggle over the line. The world number 11 also complained about the Russian qualifiers granting in a match that lasted 84 minutes. The 27-year-old will play world number 37, Jerzy Jovanovic, in his next match.
Ed Kowalski for the Classic Rock Show, where each week we spotlight the great album rock and roll of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Wednesday at 21 hours Universal Time. Join me for the Classic Rock Show, 21 hours Universal Time Wednesdays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You want to listen to the latest African music? Just tune in to the African Beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
African Beat. We love it.
I feel good.
But right now, you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports with Sonny Young. So check it out.
Indeed, you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports, coming to you live from Washington. Now let's join Daybreak Africa's Mark Home in Johannesburg, South Africa, for more sports news. Mark begins with athletics.
Kenyans Dennis Kipruto Kimeto and Jairus Kipchoge Birech, along with Botswana's Nigel Amos, are among 10 nominees for the 2014 World Male Athlete of the Year Award the World Athletics Governing Body IAAF revealed in Monaco. Kimeto recently stole the limelight when he improved the world marathon record by 26 seconds to 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds at the Berlin Marathon in Germany. Birech has been in dominant form in the 3,000-meter steeplechase during the IAAF Diamond League. He also won the event at the IAAF Continental Cup in Marrakech, Morocco. Birech is the only athlete this year to run the 3,000-meter steeplechase in under 8 minutes. Botswana's Amos is the World Diamond League 800-meter winner. He also clinched the gold medal at the British Commonwealth Games, the African Championships and IAAF Continental Cup. Staying in Monaco, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba is the only African among the 10 nominees for the 2014 World Female Athlete of the Year Award. Dibaba was in scintillating form during the indoor season, where she set two world indoor records, won gold medals at the World Indoor Championships and IAAF Continental Cup. Voting for the top three nominees in the men's and women's categories is open to the public and closes on the 16th of October, the IAAF disclosed. In football, Rwanda has intensified its crackdown on 60 top football players to determine if they change their identity in order to secure Rwanda's citizenship. Rwanda Football Federation Secretary General Olivier Mulindahabi told the Kigali media on Monday that any player who may have changed their names must revert back to their original identity and nationality before they can reapply for Rwanda citizenship through the proper channels. Mulindahabi says they are working closely with the police and immigration authorities on the matter. This investigation comes in the wake of Rwanda's disqualification from the ongoing 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers in August for fielding Dadi Birori, who had a Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo passports bearing different names and dates of birth. Finally, hosts Namibia beat Algeria 3-1 in Windhoek as Zambia and visitors Cameroon drew 0-0 in Lusaka in women's friendly matches over the weekend.
Mark Homer reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks. Meanwhile, Olympic swimming great Michael Phelps has been suspended for 6 months from U.S. swimming sanctioned competition after his arrest for driving under the influence in the U.S. city of Baltimore last week. In announcing the decision Monday, USA Swimming also said Phelps will be withdrawn from the 2015 World Championships team and that he will forfeit his funding from the national governing board for 6 months. The 29-year-old Phelps was charged last Tuesday with driving under the influence, excessive speed, and crossing double lanes. Phelps tweeted on Sunday that he would be taking time away to attend, in his words, a program that will provide the help I need to better understand myself. And that's it for this edition of the Sunday Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Simpoga. Sunny Young will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, the International Crisis Group says it could see Zimbabwe sliding into a failed state. We'll find out why they say this. And in Malawi, efforts for a national identification system for its citizens have made little progress. First, here's Tosin of Nigeria with a live version of Resolve to Love.
your shadow walking by. You said to me that you'll be right here by my side. I looked around for you. Oh, wait. I only saw you in my dream. Tell me how can we stay on and on this way? Tell me how can we open a new chapter in our world? They've got to resolve. They've got to resolve to love, They've got to resolve. To resolve,
Tosin with Resolve to Love. Well, the International Crisis Group says it could see Zimbabwe sliding into a failed state. It says several factors are contributing to their conclusions. Mounting tensions in the ruling ZANU-PF over President Robert Mugabe's succession, First Lady Grace Mugabe's entrance into mainstream politics, and the dire economic crisis. In its latest report titled Zimbabwe Waiting for the Future, the ICG says Zimbabwe's politics and economy are precarious, raising the need for ZANU-PF to choose President Mugabe's successor at the party's elective December Congress. Reporter Blessing Zulu spoke with ICG Group Southern Africa Project Director Pius Peju.
Well, the majority of the assessment that is done by the International Crisis Group is something that I not only need to agree with, but it's something that is resonating with how we have continued to see things broadly as civil society, but in particular when it comes to me as a political analyst. And the challenge that we faced, blessing you agree with me, is that post-2013, the zero-sum game politics that we have had, which is a winner-takes-all, sort of like a political scenario, does not help the country move forward. This is the very reason why we have a ZANU-PF government that appears clueless on how to manage the economy. This is the very reason why we have a ZANU-PF government, but also an opposition on the other end that seems not to have any clue in terms of how to rebuild the nation in terms of promoting national cohesion. What has been needed or what is needed in Zimbabwe at the moment is the capacity, one, for ZANU-PF to redefine or to define clearly who takes over post President Mugabe, and then for the entire nation to be able to chart a way forward that allows the entire nation to come together, one, to redefine the national question, and then two, to dialogue and build consensus around what exactly needs to be done. Now, the problem with zero-sum politics is that when the opposition leader, President Morgan Tsvangirai, put this up to ZANU-PF, that he thought that it was going to be prudent for ZANU-PF to consider dialogue with the MDC. ZANU-PF's reaction was that there is no need for dialogue in this country. It is zero-sum game politics.
The International Crisis Group is also saying that to avoid prolonged uncertainty and a possible crisis, ZANU-PF should decide conclusively at its December Congress who will replace President Robert Mugabe. What are the chances that this will be done?
The chances are next to none.
That was International Crisis Group Southern Africa Project Director Pius Piju speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu from Pretoria. In Malawi, despite attempts by successive governments for a national identification system, little progress has been made. Citizens of that country remain unaccounted for through a national ID system. VOA's Chipolero Kansalanga reports.
Malawians are currently using driving licenses, passports, and in some cases, voter registration certificates as a proof of their citizenship in places and institutions where identification is needed. Those who don't have such documents are asked to bring any person with a passport or driving license to be a witness. Malawians who cannot fulfill such requirements cannot get assistance in places like commercial banks and money lending institutions. Janet Manda is a small-scale businesswoman in Malawi's commercial capital, Blanta. She told VOA that it took her more than 3 months to convince a person to be her witness to get a loan to start her business in 2005.
Tidakumana kumalo obwerekisana ndalama, anthu ambiri anakana kundipira kumboni. Chifukwa amaopa
kuti. She says many people with passports were refusing to confirm her citizenship before the money lending institutions in fear of being penalized in case she runs away with the money or failed to repay the loan. But she says she was saved by one lady who offered to help on condition that she should be her business partner. Heavy authorities say the absence of the national IDs is putting a strain on medical resources because foreigners come to take advantage of free medical services in public hospitals, particularly in border districts. Harold Kabuluz is the spokesperson for the District Health Office, which borders Mozambique in central Malawi.
Last year we did the scan at the hospital and we found out that almost half of our inpatients are Mozambican. So when we ask them, they just mention border villages. But if those IDs are introduced in Malawi, we'll be able to trace which ones are Malawians and which ones are Mozambican.
Kabuluzi says the hospital's budget for medical supplies has always failed to meet the demand. Campaigners against child trafficking say lack of identification is contributing to an increase in trafficking cases. Hastings Jumbe is the president of Journalists Against Child Trafficking.
In fact, most of the time when somebody is taking kids from another place to the other, you'd actually have difficulties just to know who are these kids. What's the relationship between that trafficker and the kids themselves? Because most of the time when you ask them, they actually tell you, these are my kids, these are my relatives, so I'm taking them to somewhere. So you wouldn't even force someone to identify himself, yet the ID is not there.
Malawi's government introduced the National Registration Bureau in 2007 to oversee the process of issuing national identity documents. But 7 years since its inception, the Bureau has yet to issue IDs. Spokesperson Norman Flatila told VOA the Bureau has a financial constraints.
It is the procurement of equipment which will enable NRC to produce.
He says it is the procurement of the equipment that will enable the National Registration Bureau to produce identification documents in the form of birth certificates, national IDs, and marriage certificates, and that has not been done. So he says the Bureau could not tell when they will start issuing the certificates. In the current national budget, the Bureau has been allocated less than a quarter of the money it needs, which Fratila says is likely to further stall the issuance of IDs. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As world leaders met last month in New York for the opening of the 69th session of the United Nations General Assembly, the United States worked to focus greater attention and pressure toward ending the political crisis in South Sudan. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called a September 25th high-level meeting to discuss the dire humanitarian crisis caused by the conflict there and the growing frustration in the international community that despite President Salva Kiir's and former Vice President Riek Machar's recommitment to cease hostilities, fighting continues. Even as the parties resumed national unity talks in Ethiopia, mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, government troops and opposition forces loyal to the former vice president clashed again in Upper Nile State, leaving almost 200 dead. U.S. officials taking part in the UN meeting told participants that the fighting has driven 1.8 million people, close to 20% of the population, from their homes, almost 500,000 of them into refugee camps in neighboring nations. Some 40% of South Sudanese are in need of food assistance, all in a man-made crisis that can only be settled through inclusive peace talks, not on the battlefield. Ambassador Donald Booth is U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan.
We urge that everyone who has been party to the talks to date, whether the political parties, civil society, the religious communities, be allowed to continue to participate in the negotiations.
Fighting erupted in December 2013 when a political dispute within the country's ruling party, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, turned violent. Political conflict erupted into intercommunal fighting with a cost of more than 10,000 lives. The United States and international community are putting pressure on the warring parties in other ways as well. The United States has imposed sanctions on individuals from both sides of the conflict who are responsible for gross violations of human rights or violations of the cessation of hostilities agreement. More may be imposed. Again, Ambassador Booth.
We will continue to look with our Troika EU partners and IGAD, other ways of increasing the costs of continuing the conflict as a way of pressuring the parties to negotiate seriously.
The United States is fully supportive of the IGAD mediation effort and stands with the people of South Sudan. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar must assume their responsibilities to prevent further needless suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
The people of the nation, the best thing that they can do is to try as best as possible to cooperate with the health authorities and to listen to and adhere to the suggestions and guidelines. We appreciate that this is something that is really awful to be going through. We're with you, we have solidarity with you, and hopefully we'll be able to end this terrible epidemic very soon.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking to VOA on the Ebola crisis.